Support for National Native News and Juno Afternoon comes from Clinkin and Haida social enterprises like Sacred Grounds Coffee, Sacred Shine Auto Detailing, and Smokehouse Catering. Learn more at www.ccthita-nsn.gov. Clinkin and Haida. Local. Indigenous. Proud.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Tlanedi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. The tidelands where our studios sit are now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots, but they were once a source of food, a place to maintain smokehouses, a place to gather driftwood for fuel. In sharing this history, KTOO hopes to honor the ancestors and the descendants of the Occoquan. We recognize those families who have never relinquished their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways and continue to cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront for today and for future generations. Gnatchish.
Hansen Grass, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, where Kashuk are ye tin. Jin Katka Ke Jin Tauk Anakaya Haanikak, Gunshish.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. National Public Radio dubbed Jason Vio as, quote, perhaps one of the most precise and soulful classical guitarists of his generation. We're about to find out why. Jason Vio is in town for the Juno Jazz and Classics Hybrid Festival. Joins us now in our KTOO studios. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much for being here today. You are the first live guest that I've hosted here in the studio in over a year, and I think you're going to be a tough act to follow.
Oh, thank you.
Well, would you please introduce yourself?
Well, my name is Jason Vio. I'm a classical guitarist and originally from Buffalo, New York. And I started guitar, I think maybe like a week or so after my eighth birthday. And I guess we can get into a little bit more of that. Do you want you just know more about my background?
Sure. I would love to hear a little bit more about how you decided that you were going to dedicate your life to classical guitar.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. A lot of it was serendipity because my family background is not really in entertainment or music or anything like that, really. Being from Buffalo, a lot of the industry from my parents' generation and their parents' generation was some of it was on the lakes, you know, because it's Buffalo's on Lake Erie. And so there's, I come from a long line of coal passers, that kind of, on Laker boats and stuff. So that's kind of what my dad's line was. And then my father sort of broke from that tradition. And he was an appliance repairman. And my mother was a secretary. And so I got into music really just through discovering their record collection. Initially, when I was 3 years old, and I listened to my dad's jazz records, but mostly I was really into my mom's record collection initially because it was all that great soul R&B kind of stuff from the 50s and 60s, Junior Walker and the All-Stars and Four Tops, Temptations, Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin, like the Stax and Motown singles. And then a lot of the rock and roll, like the Beatles. My mom had four Beatles LPs. Which I completely fell in love with, and Mamas and the Papas and Love and Spoonful and stuff like that. So that's typically what a lot of my parents' generation would have in their record collection. So my mother, noticing that I, of my own volition, spent most of my free time just listening to records, like listening to music. When I was five, she brought home a guitar for me from a guitar store, like a $50 guitar, probably not realizing that it was a classical guitar. It was actually like a nylon string classical guitar, but like two thirds of the size of an adult one. And so I just knocked around on it and played things by ear. And the serendipity part was, again, is my mother happened to, for a few years, I think 2 years, she worked as a secretary at my elementary school. The Buffalo Guitar Quartet came to that school to give an outreach program, not unlike what I'm probably going to be doing for a couple of things around here. This is a residency week for me. Mm-hmm. And So I started taking my first guitar lessons were with a classical guitarist, and I didn't really know any different. So I just started studying with Jeremy Sparks, and that was it. And I just liked it. I was one of those. I was kind of, I guess, unusual in the sense that I would go to, I would just practice. I would, you know, if I had, he would give me the assignments and homework, essentially, like it would be at school. And I would, and my parents really never had to tell me to practice. So,
Did you ever try to transcribe your Motown favorites from the record collection?
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's initially, like, playing things by ear was what really just came natural to me. And so then as I developed an actual technique with classical guitar, I found that I could actually physically play the things that I was already hearing by ear. So like a lot of the top 40 and stuff that was on the radio, I would, my brother and sister would get a kick out of me playing like a Human League or something like that, or, you know, Duran Duran or something that was on the radio in those days. So, yeah, it would knock them out. They'd be like, wait a minute, that's like, sounds like, you know, and I'd even kind of try to imitate the sound of the synthesizer or the bass guitar or the drum, you know, thing or whatever it was. And, those kind of things, if you have a predilection to that, like if you have an aptitude for that, they really develop when you start learning a lot of technique, because then you can play more often what you already are kind of hearing in your head.
Yeah.
You pick it out or transcribe it off the radio, you know, and then later in high school it was like Steely Dan solos and stuff like that, you know.
And you've also transcribed a number of classical composers.
Yeah, classical composers. I do a lot of arrangements of jazz things and popular music. I'll play one of those today for you. Like, I mean, one of them that the audiences seem to like is What a Wonderful World, which is a well-known song, of course.
Excellent. Well, as a professional musician, now that you are all grown up, what are some other things that you're known for? What makes you stand out?
I don't know. I think the thing for me is that I don't really concentrate very much on that aspect of it. I'm so very much involved in what I'm doing because I do a lot of different things. I mean, I play concertos with orchestra. I do a lot of world premieres, like probably about two, sometimes even three a year, either for solo guitar, chamber music with other instruments, or guitar and orchestra. And that in particular, the last 10 years has really been a focus. And playing solo recitals and going to chamber music festivals and curating a guitar-oriented program for their audience. And it's just kind of like I just go around and I can do things like that, kind of create things that are programs for a particular audience.
All right. Well, let's get to the music. I can't wait any longer. First live music we've had in Studio 2K here at KTOO.
Why don't I play What a Wonderful World?
Thanks, Jason. That was so beautiful.
Thank you.
A little more emotional than I thought I would be. I having our first live musician in the studio after so long. What was this last year like for you as a performer?
Oh, it was horrible. It was especially because I really enjoy the whole thing. I'm very much like a road dog in that sense. I like the hotels and. I mean, the flying is a bit boring, but it's all, you know, all the stuff that you have to do to play music for people. My audience is very much, I think, really connected in that way to me. Like, they listen really hard, if that makes sense. And so being away from them for quite a long time was really disorienting for me. But the upside was the thing that was nice about it. I was able to spend more time, of course, a lot more time with my wife and kids at home. So that was really good. And we got to bond in a way that we didn't, you know, we wouldn't normally quite get to do. So.
What kind of guitar do you play there?
The guitar is made by a German luthier named Gernot Wagner. And Wagner is based in Frankfurt. And, yeah, he makes very, very nice instruments. I've been playing his guitars for about, I want to say, almost about 15 years now.
And you don't use a pick. You have a really original and unique method to play. Will you tell us about your thumbnail there?
Well, the nails, playing with nails is the standard way of course, playing classical guitar. Because as you heard with my arrangement of What a Wonderful World, there's a bass line happening, there's a groove happening with the other two fingers of the right hand. And then I'm playing the melody with various fingers of my right hand all at the same time. So that's basically what we think of on the guitar as a classical technique, a classically trained kind of technique. The thing that is, I guess, unique to me and something that NPR really latched onto years ago. Oh, gosh, I mean, this is almost 20 years ago now. It's amazing. When I was a young artist in residence on NPR in 2002 for Performance Today when it was back in D.C. And they wanted to do a whole segment on me actually making one of these ping pong ball nails, which is, so what I use, I call it the professional necessity. My real thumb, my actual thumbnail, unlike my other three, the three nails that I use, we use four of our five nails for plucking. And unlike the other three, my real thumbnail doesn't really grow long enough to do what I need it to do. And so the ping pong ball actually is the most standard, I mean, in our little fishbowl, it's the most common replacement or substitute for when you break a nail. Like if I was on the way to the radio station here today and I used my right hand to open the car door, which I would never do as a guitarist, right? And I smashed one of my nails, I would have like a replacement. You know, I always have a ping pong ball in my guitar case for that reason, and a tube of crazy glue and all that stuff. Yeah, the nail file, the Revlon nail file, and the automotive grade sandpaper and all these things. Although I don't have a lot of stuff in my kit. I have to say, some guitarists, man, they got like a lot of things. They got 15 different grades of sandpaper. I just have the one and the nail file, and that's it.
Well, that's really interesting. Definitely something new I learned today.
And if you learn something new every day, your day is not wasted. That's my advice.
Well, you're here today to perform at Juno Jazz and Classics, and a big part of that is Zool Bailey. Tell me about your relationship to Zool Bailey. How did you get connected to him and to the festival?
Zool and I have a lot of mutual friends in the classical music world, and Zool is you know, one of the great cello soloists, and he came... You know, I had a lot of friends tell me, "Oh, you should do you know Zool?" And it's like I knew his name, but I had never really met him. And he came and gave a master class at one of the conservatories that I teach at. I'm based in Cleveland, and he came to Cleveland Institute of Music, and to do a class, like a master class. And so, so I said hello to him then, and then I kind of kept in touch with him a little bit later, and then he brought me to his El Paso series, and I did that solo. I was a soloist with the symphony, El Paso Symphony, and did a solo recital, and again, various outreach. There are a lot of them are structured similarly. You do a lot of outreach to the community, and radio and such. And he felt that that was a success and brought me to Mesa, Arizona, to another one of the things that he has with a famous harpist that I've played with for years, Yolanda Condonassis. And then he said, he's like, I'm going to bring you to, you got to come to Alaska. And I told him, at the time I said, you know, I have a lot of, my family, my last name has a lot of connection to Juneau in that my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Jacques Viau, was a fur trader and from Quebec, and he settled the first trading post in what later became Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was the first non-Native American, basically, there. And he traded peacefully and lived amongst the Menominee tribe, and he married a Menominee woman. And and they basically did business with him, like, his whole life. But as his trading post and his stature in the community grew, he needed a partner. And so he hired Solomon Juneau as his partner there, and Solomon Juneau's cousin founded Juneau, Alaska.
That is quite a story. I had not read that about you in my research. So is this your first time in Alaska?
This is my first. I have been to Fairbanks as a soloist with a symphony a couple times, but never to Juneau. So this is my first time in Juneau. I had always wanted to come to Juneau, again, because of my family history. If you look in Wikipedia, my four greats grandfather is there. If you look up Juneau, and then go, and Solomon's name is in there too.
Wow.
So, yeah.
All right. So do you draw inspiration from places like this with such dramatic landscapes, or is inspiration coming from other places?
I'm just happy to see them. I mean, they're just really beautiful. I didn't realize, it's different from Fairbanks. It's like there's that. I mean, I was not prepared for how beautiful it is. I mean, I can't wait to, we're trying to schedule like a whale watching tour or something where I can get around and really get up and close to the mountains or anything like that is great. I was blown away. As we landed, I was struck by how close to the mountains you are when you're landing. You're kind of landing in a valley, right?
Yeah.
And they call it, and then later, as I got here last night, I found out that this where I'm staying is actually called the Valley.
Yes, that's right. So, yeah. So I wanted to ask, you know, what else are you planning to do while you're here in Juneau?
Well, that's it.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, you did.
I think I'm only going to have time for like one kind of sightseeing thing, and it's going to be, I think we're hooking up a whale watch type of thing.
Excellent.
Yeah, on a boat.
Do you compose original music?
I do. Would you like to hear one? Would you like to hear one of my tunes?
Yes, let's hear it.
Well, the one I have that I'm playing, if you come to the Jazz and Classics, I'm playing that in the program, but it's too long, I think, really, to play on the radio. I started writing a lot more. I wrote I wrote an entire record of worth of music, well over 60 minutes, actually, during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Because when all these performing musicians' concerts were canceled, I mean, everything was kind of wiped out for a year going forward. And the first 2 months, while I became acclimated to actually being home every day, which is very strange. I've been on the road for like 25 years, not continuously, but the last 15 years, more than half of the year, every single year, year in, year out. The last 10 years, like 2/3 of the year for sure. And so it was awesome, but I had to really become used to being home every day. And since there was nothing to prepare, I was like an animal. I would just prepare music for the next week and the next week after that. And next week, you know, I play about 8 or 9 hours of music every year, different music. And so I was like, well, what do I do? I didn't know what to do with myself because I wasn't used to, I hadn't practiced just to practice the guitar just to keep up my chops since I was like a kid. So my wife, told me when she met me, she's like, you should write music because I'm always coming up with stuff anyway and improvising and stuff. And she said, I said, 10 years ago, I was like, yeah, I mean, I could write. I just, there's absolutely no time for it. So we agreed that would be the good time, way to pass, to use that time because I was probably never going to get it back again. You know, during the pandemic was a really golden opportunity. And I wrote tons of stuff. So, and I'm performing them now in concerts, which is nice.
Great. You think you'll release an album?
That's good. Yeah, that's in the works. And the record company is like very interested in a record, in actual being one of the future CDs. We got to get the Bach CD out first. But that's coming in October.
All so, right.
Yeah.
Well, that is that all that's next. What else is next for you after Juno Jazz and Classics?
Basically that. I mean, all I've got a date with Pittsburgh Symphony coming up a couple weeks after that, and then I'm at Steamboat, Colorado, with Julian Lebrow, longtime collaborator on the jazz. He's a jazz accordion player, and that's at the end of June. So not tons of stuff, not what I'm used to. I mean, it's like two gigs in June. There's like I'm playing with Branford Marsalis. We're doing a world premiere of a soprano saxophone and guitar piece. That is super exciting because I listened to Branford on all those Sting records, solo records, when I was in high school and college. I was a huge fan of those records. And Branford and his brother Winton and stuff. So that's really exciting. That's in July. A couple other gigs in July around there. In August, I go to Napa and Moab for festivals. And so, yeah, it's what's happening really is it's starting to come back, like in these little in dribs and drabs and stuff. So I'm definitely, my hands are full, you know, in the summer with repertoire because all those gigs are different. They're all different music. And the Branford, the piece is written by Pierre Jalbert. And so that's an actual piece, like, you know, 16 minutes. So I'm going to be very busy getting that ready as soon as I come back from Juno. But I'm going to enjoy this time. This is a nice time for me. It's very real. I already know all these pieces pretty well. So I'm going to just enjoy this.
Well, I would be honored if you'd play us another one.
Sure, sure. So this is Misionera by Fernando Bustamante. This is from Argentina. And this will be part of my Wide World of Guitar on Thursday at 5:30 and 7:30 shows. And this is arranged for the guitar by Jorge Morel.
Absolutely wonderful. Thank you, Jason Vio. Well, you are, I would say, the headliner, at least one of the main performers of Juno Jazz and Classics this year, happening this week. And we really appreciate you playing for us today here on Juno Afternoon, considering your concerts are already sold out.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
Well, I think that everybody was really ready for this. And Juno is ready to get out and about and see some live performances. But I'm just so honored that you could be here today and play for us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for being here. All right. Well, my first guest back. I don't even know how to wrap this up. I forget all the things that we used to do. But thanks so much for being here, Jason Vio, and have a great time while you're here in Juneau.
Thank you. Will do.
This is Bird Note. Ojibwe writer Hyde Erdrich's poem, DNA Tribes, was inspired by two things. First, in the early days of the internet, some annoying targeted ads.
They would always ask me if I wanted to learn about my Native American DNA and if I knew my tribe, which of course I did.
And the other was the red-eyed vireo, whose call sounds like someone saying,
"Here I am, where are you?" And I thought, like, why would a bird be saying that? I felt the two things together. You know, do you have to move away from where you are, mislead people from who you are, to keep your home safe? DNA Tribes. The red-eyed vireo calls, "Here I am, where are you?" Like some bizarre biomimic web ads pop up while I email asking, "Native American DNA, what tribe are you?" All I'd need to do is swab and mail away cells my ancestors took millennia to perfect. And who owns them then? "Here I am, where are you?" the red-eyed vireo calls, misleading us to relocate, following its flight, away from nestlings tight in twigs, to get us lost in a bog. Asking all along if we even know our own locale, "Here I am, where are you? Native American DNA, what tribe are you?" As if that could fool us, make us forget the nesting grounds, the red eye cast ever backward to a place always known as home.
We need water to stay healthy. Alaskans use this precious resource to clean, cook, and stay hydrated. Water plant operators in communities across the state protect our health by providing safe water and sanitation service. Whether water is piped to your home, available at a washateria, or delivered by a haul vehicle, it's the expertise and dedication of hardworking Alaskans that make it possible. Thank your local water plant operator today. This message brought to you by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
Thank you.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years with 7 cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my next guest is here to talk about Asian Pacific Islander Heritage Month and a community conversation, a time to celebrate Alaska's diverse Asian cultures, but also this year, time to reflect on some serious issues facing Asians and Pacific Islanders. Perseverance Theater will hold a community conversation to be streamed live at 6 o'clock tomorrow night. My guest is Adriana Lee, Program Coordinator. Adriana, would you like to introduce yourself for our listeners?
Awesome. Thank you so much. My name is Adriana Lee. I'm hailing from Impact, which is in Boston, Massachusetts. My pronouns are she and they. And do you want me to just do sort of a general introduction of my involvement first?
That would be great.
Yeah. So I work with a nonprofit self-defense organization known as Impact Boston. I've been with Impact for about 3.5, almost 4 years now. And we teach a wide variety of self-defense and advocacy for all communities. We focus on physical skills as well as verbal skills, de-escalation, assertiveness and boundary setting, as well as safety strategies for marginalized communities, which is what I will be lending and sort of focusing on as we're going into API and Asian American Heritage Month, and the importance of everything that's been going on in recent events.
So what does Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month mean to you?
So I am I'm a native Bostonian, but for my roots, I am half Puerto Rican and half Chinese. And for myself and my experience growing up as a mixed race, a biracial Asian American, what it means to me, especially now with recent events, is more than just pride, more than just myself, but an attachment to my community. I'm pretty big into martial arts as well as the Boston Chinatown community. And so I've been working a lot with Impact and with other organizations to sort of bring safety to different AAPI communities for survivors, for elderly communities, for those that are facing race-based harassment. And so what it really means to me, I think, going into this month is safety and how to find that in diverse communities. So that's what I'm sort of bringing to this work.
Thanks. And Leslie Ishii has joined us. She is the Artistic Director at Perseverance Theater and a panelist for the community conversation, as is Adriana. Hi, Leslie. We're live right now, so thanks for hopping on the Zoom.
Hi, thanks so much for having us. As we have so many Zoom meetings, I just zoomed right over as soon as I could. Thanks so much for your presence and grace.
I was asking Adriana what Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month meant to her, and I was wondering if I could ask you the same question.
Oh, thank you for that question. Well, I'm Japanese American, Yonsei, fourth generation, and certainly from the Northwest, born and raised in Seattle, and have been back and forth up here to Juno Douglas on Tlingit Ani. And it means a great deal to be able to uplift our leaders, uplift our histories here, and which are really rich here in Alaska and throughout the Great Northwest and Southeast. And so much has been going on, of course, with the COVID kind of climate. So it seemed like a really important opportunity to lift up those issues and also lift up all the work that our leaders are doing throughout Alaska.
How did the idea for this community conversation that's happening tomorrow night come about?
It came about for many reasons. Again, I'm Asian American. And last year we weren't able to really focus because we were so deep pivoting around all the shutdowns and staff and, you know, what we could do to keep Perseverance Theater going. But this year we were able to pivot and be able to certainly recognize this month. And it's meant a lot because in this time of COVID, when we've heard so much rhetoric, you know, that's anti-Asian. And I'll be honest, I have had my own incidents of racism, of very much due to COVID, being accosted being blamed for the virus, that I thought, how can I heal? I don't like to stay victim. I taught to heal and by empowering myself. And I thought, how can I take leadership and bring like Adriana with us to support our empowerment and to lift up other leaders who are doing really beautiful and important social justice work in our communities so that we don't fall victim. It also came about because I'm looking at how can we, and thank you at KTOO for this moment to be able to share with folks. Please do join us. It's a moment to learn. I think what's powerful about Alaska is we have a lot of cross-cultural, cross-racial learning because we're so diverse. We're some of the most diverse communities in the U.S. So tuning in and getting a chance to get to know us and understand some of these issues, but and learning the history that might not be lifted up or goes unnoticed or untold or erased even. It's a great learning moment for all of us.
Adriana, who are you hoping will attend this conversation and what do you hope will be discussed or what connections do you hope to make?
That's a great question. Truthfully, I'm really hoping everyone will be joining the conversation. And by everyone, I mean collectively, not just those that are Asian American identified, not just those that are from certain regions, and not just allies, right? I'm hoping everyone can sort of come to the conversation and come together. What I'm noticing a lot, not just in the self-defense classes, but where I'm sort of seeing these conversations happening, I think holistically we're becoming pretty divisive. And sometimes that stems from passion. Sometimes that stems from trauma, but sometimes it stems from ignorance and not really being a part of fluid conversations back and forth, accepting differences, understanding each other. So truthfully, the connections I'm hoping to make is people from different perspectives, different walks of life, you know, gender, age, experiences directly with race-based harassment, and those who have never experienced it. For me, what would feel empowering and sort of what we tend to focus on is bringing everyone to the conversation so that those voices can be uplifted and heard correctly to sort of stop a lot of the assumptions that are being made, even when folks' hearts are in the right place. So I'm hoping to just reach far and wide and hopefully open minds and open hearts.
Today, as I'm sure you're both aware, is the anniversary of the killing of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. So it's a ripe moment for having conversations about race and racism. Any reflections on that from either of you?
Absolutely. I've been in other spaces today where we have been commemorating George Floyd's murder. And then, of course, in this community, not that long ago, the Atlanta shootings as well. And since George Floyd and other countless Black cousins and family members who have community members that have suffered at the hands of violence, anti-Blackness, it's a moment to come together and to build solidarity, like Adriana was saying, against those stereotypes, and really to look at what has been systemic. It happens so much now, or it's been brought to light, and you can see how the rapidity of it, the repetition of it. So it's systemic. It's not a one-off here or one-off there. You can see that it's built in. That's white supremacy culture. So how can we come together, have these conversations so that we can help each other detect it when it's happening, dismantle it or resist it, as they say, and do different, you know, work on being anti-racist together. And it does take everyone doing it together. It's very difficult to achieve that alone. So even at Perseverance Theater, we work on it as a team. We don't work on it individually. And in the community, we're working to foster that. So we work on it together.
Adriana, what would you add?
I would definitely echo that. And I know for me on a personal level, it doesn't feel like it's been a year. In some ways, it feels like it's been longer. In some ways, it's been shorter. And I think part of that is just us all kind of collectively still dealing with that and kind of not spiraling, but still wringing from it, you know, as a biracial person, but as a just a human dealing with sort of the trauma of that and the focus points of that, it doesn't just go away. It's not something in the news that we can just turn the page because it's been a year and sort of move on from the next things. The ripple effects from the murder of George Floyd and everything that sort of lent it to even more divisiveness and misunderstandings, I think, really is extended at this point. So I would say, keeping in mind that it's not over. We've got a long way to go. And this is just one of many of the injustices that we're really looking to hopefully one day stop.
Mm-hmm. Still ringing from it is a great way to put it. I wish we could talk more about this. I'm sorry, I don't have a little bit more time, but let's talk about the details of the community conversation. When is it and how can we join in?
It's tomorrow, Wednesday, from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. And we'll be streaming it so that you can watch it on our Facebook page, Perseverance Theater's Facebook page, or our YouTube page. And we hope you do tune in. Adriana will be there. Dennis Arashiro, who's the president of the Japanese American Citizens League, and our very own Edric Carrillo of the Filipino Community Inc. Really excited. We've had some preliminary conversations already with Adriana. It's been fantastic. We look forward to bringing you along with us in those conversations.
Thank you both so much for your time today and for being on the air and for sharing everything. And best of luck with the conversation tomorrow, 6 p.m.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Well, when it rains in Juno, sometimes you just got to roll with it. So I'm here with Lauren Anderson, Treadwell Arena Manager, here to talk about roller skating. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. Before we talk about roller skating at the arena, can you give me a little status update? I know you guys have been closed for a long time.
Well, we're just closed for the season. We close every summer. And so we closed April 26th, and we've been just doing some projects around the facility and preparing to open for roller skating next Friday. And we'll do 4 weeks of roller skating every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. And we haven't done this for 4 years, and we're really excited to bring it back this year. So yeah, we're excited every Friday, 6 to 7. There is registration required, and that's through the city's Parks and Recreation website, and it's $5 admission, and payment is required when you register. Do you have questions? And maybe I can fill in more of the information.
What kind of memories do you have of roller skating when you were a kid? I know I used to love the roller rink.
I did. I've always loved roller skating, and I was never that good at roller skating. Honestly, I was much better on the ice, but my first memories of roller skating were with the strap-on roller skates just in the neighborhood that strapped onto your shoes.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a long time ago, but it was a lot of fun, and roller skating in my house and then transitioning to the roller rink, which is now a bookstore in the community that I grew up in.
Do you think roller skating has seen a resurgence in the last few years with roller derby becoming so popular? And, I see a lot of roller skating videos on TikTok.
It's true. And I hadn't realized it until recently that I'd kind of been reading a little bit more about kind of this boom back of roller skating back into people's activities and exercise. And it's great to see, and we're excited to be part of that in the Juno community.
Well, what will it be like for those who come to skate at Treadwell?
Well, like I said, we are requiring registration in advance and payment. So then we'll have the doors open for you so you can walk right in. Check in when you get in so that we know that you were registered. And we will have the same setup we did with ice skating, where we have individual stools set up throughout our lobby so that people are social distancing and feeling safe. So folks can just find a place to sit. And then we'll have the disco ball on, we'll have music going. And yeah, we're really excited to, like I said, bring this back. And then, yeah, and that's it. If there's music requests, we might be able to take it. I need to actually get that dialed in and figure out what station we're going to be playing, because we do have the XM radio, but yeah, there's some really great options there. So,
well, I don't want to sway your decision, but we do have two music stations here at KTOO as well.
Yeah, that's true. It'd be great if you could play some disco music from 6 to 7 on Friday night for June. Yeah,
I will see.
That would be perfect.
I will see what our DJ can do. I bet he'd be into that.
Yeah, let's plan on that.
Well, where can we find more, Lauren, and where can we check the schedule and get registered?
Well, we actually have all the information will get launched on Thursday, so that'll be on the Treadwell Arena website and on our Facebook page and on the Parks and Recreation Facebook page and website. So I would recommend folks check that out, and that should give you all the information. There will be flyers around town. They're getting printed right now, so you should, if you're listening today, yeah, keep your eye out for more information about roller skating on Friday nights at Treadwell, 6 to 7 p.m.
Thank you so much. I appreciate all the info. Looking forward to being able to get out and skate. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners before we say goodbye today?
You know, the types of skates, that tends to be a question. And we just want to remind folks that we are allowing roller skating, roller skates, derby skates, inline skates, or speed skates. We actually don't have the skates here at the rink, so we require folks to bring their own.
Bring your own skates.
So that's an important piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really good to know. Cool. All right. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. So thanks for doing what you do, Lauren.
Yeah, thank you. We're looking forward to seeing you next Friday. The first one is June 4th, then the 11th, 18th, and 25th.
Excellent. Thanks again so much. It sounds like a blast.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
You too.
Thanks so much for joining me today on Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow we'll hear from Theater Alaska about music in a neighborhood near you, Alaska Public Gardens Day, and how reducing carbon emissions starts at home. Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Clinkett and Haida Social Enterprises. Until tomorrow, have a great Juno evening.